Okay, so I have spent almost a whole year now going through the stories of Jesus. And most of you have heard me do stories about the parables, but this last about year now, I've been not doing the stories Jesus told, but the stories that we've seen in the Gospels about Jesus. And I kind of ended up focusing on stories in John. And then it seemed like I kind of went backwards or jumped around or skipped around. And the more I studied it and the more I got into it, the more I thought, you know, I should have done this in order because there really is an order to John. But it's too late to go back and do that now. But what I want to talk about today is the very first story that we have in the Gospel of John about Jesus and what he did. So we looked a lot at stories about things that Jesus did, like the clearing of the temple. And then we looked at his miracles and talked some about the importance of the miracles being not just shows of power, but signs. And so today we're going to focus on signs and what that meant for the people who were looking at the signs. So in Jesus' culture, if Jesus' miracles were just shows of power, like we look at the miracle of, say, feeding the 5,000 and we say, oh, look what Jesus did. He's so powerful. We look at miracles of him healing. Look what Jesus did. He's so powerful. But here's the thing. In Jesus' culture, that power would not necessarily mean that he was from God. People would not look at the power that he had and say, oh, he's so powerful, he must be from God, or he must be God. Because they were used to shows of power. They had magicians who would show power. They had people who, with the help of demons, would show power. In fact, Jesus was even accused of this once, using demonology to be the prop of his power. And they were also used to their kings and their rulers being considered as demigods. So I don't know if you remember, this is not a Bible story, but it's an extra-biblical story about King Herod. He was parading in front of his people in Caesarea Maritima, and the sun came out of the clouds, and it glinted on his fabulous gold-flecked robe that he was wearing, and it looked like he was made of gold, and all the people bowed down and worshipped him because they considered this a show of power. Well, God stepped in and he's like, no. And Herod died not very long after that happened. So the idea of looking at Jesus doing this power and people believing on him because of that power is not where we want to end up. Yes, Jesus had power. Yes, his power came from God. But this was not a convincing show for those people. Okay, I'm going to take this real quick to our own culture right now. We have a culture of that our kids are growing up in. We've got Santa Claus, we've got the Tooth Fairy when they're really little, but then they graduate to things like Spider-Man, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, all these powerful figures. Power is not an unusual thing, even in our culture. What we run the risk of, if we just focus on these miracles as Jesus' power, is we run the risk of our kids, when they grow up and realize Batman's not real, Superman can't really do that. And Jesus fits into that same category, and he just goes out with the bathwater as well. There's no difference if all we focus on is power. So we're going to take a look at the signs behind Jesus' powerful miracles. And we've already done that. Your watch is making noise. I'm not sure what it's doing, but every now and then it just goes beep, beep. So I can deal with it. But
it's just getting text messages.
Okay.
You can ignore it. You're okay with it?
Look at that power, right? In Jesus' day, that would be a show of power. To us, it's not a big deal, right? So power is fleeting. The impression of power is fleeting. So let's not just focus on the power. The miracles that Jesus performed were signs. And to be able to read a sign, you have to be able to interpret it. I don't know if any of you have ever been driving in a foreign land and the road signs are in a different language. If you can't read the sign, it doesn't mean anything to you. I was in a train station in Italy once, trying to get on the train that was going to take me to the city that I wanted to go to. And I couldn't read the signs. I couldn't tell what the signs said. And eventually, we just got on a train and hoped we ended up in the right spot. If you can't read the signs, they're not helpful to you. So you need to be able to interpret the signs. And the signs that Jesus did in his miracles were pointing to something. They're pointing from something and to something. You know where you're coming from, but the sign points you where you're going to. Jesus would often refer to the Old Testament, and we did look a lot at Jesus' references back to the Old Testament and the things that he said and the things that he did. The Pharisees also would look to the Old Testament to discover the signs, what they should look for in their Messiah. The overarching theme of the Pharisees' idea of what the Messiah should be, there's a list of prophecies that the Jews accept as messianic prophecies. Some of the ones that we as evangelical Protestants accept, they don't. They don't accept them at all. But their overarching theme in the prophecies that they accept are power, peace, and prosperity. So the power is that in these messianic prophecies, they're going to end up being rulers of the world. The peace in the prophecies, you see that in the prophecies like they'll beat their swords into plowshares. The lion shall lie down with the lamb and a little child will lead them. This is the peace that's going to come in the messianic age. Prosperity, you see that a lot with there's going to be plenty of grain and plenty of wine in the messianic age. So when the Jews are looking for the Messiah, this is the kind of thing that they're looking for. So Jesus came showing these signs. And I touched a little bit on this. I don't know how many of you guys remember what I said like 3 months ago. Because I hardly remember what I said 3 months ago, so I'm not sure that you do either. But some of the miracles that we looked at, I mentioned that these were more than just miracles, that they were signs, but I didn't really go into it very deeply. Because when I'm studying for this kind of stuff, I have like this huge conglomeration of material, and I have to decide what I'm going to talk about and what I'm going to throw in and what I'm not. And so sometimes I have this stuff and I just don't go that direction, so I don't talk about it. But I did touch a little bit on the signs that Jesus' miracles pointed to and talk just a little bit about the importance of them. So I'm going to review a little bit and maybe give you a little bit more information about these signs. So we talked about the healing of the lame man at the pool of Bethesda, right? Okay, so that was a miracle. Jesus had power, but the miracle goes beyond just the healing power. When we talked about what the Pool of Bethesda really was and that it was a pagan stronghold right next to the temple, what we saw Jesus doing when he healed this man in that pagan stronghold was we saw him rescuing a Jewish man from paganism and drawing him back to Judaism. Okay, that is one of the prophecies. Several of the prophecies talk about that. God will himself gather up the lost sheep and bring them home. So this is what that sign was. This was a sign, Jesus going into a pagan area, gathering a lost sheep of Israel and bringing him home. Then we talked about the healing of the blind man at the pool of Siloam. And Jesus' discourse after that healing, when he's talking to the Pharisees about it, lands squarely in the idea of justice. And justice is a very strong idea of what's going to happen in the Messianic Age. That healing of the blind man was a sign of the justice of the Messianic Age. Now, here's something that we did not talk about, the blind and the lame. So we have these two stories, and they both happen near the temple. And here's the thing about blind and lame people and the temple in Jerusalem. The blind and the lame were not allowed to enter the temple. So they had to stay on the outside. They could come in to the court of the Gentiles. Sometimes they could come into the court of women, but the actual temple they could not go into. That's as far as they were allowed to go. And here is the history behind that. So in the books of the law, God lays out certain ordinances for his priests. So if you're of the priestly line, you have certain duties to do. But if you're of the priestly line and you're blind or you're lame, you're not allowed to do those duties. But you're still allowed to be a priest, and you're still allowed to partake of the offerings that people bring. You're still taken care of as if you were a priest. So you had all the rights of priesthood, but you didn't have the responsibilities of priesthood. Okay, so you were taken care of. You just weren't allowed to go into the temple and the Holy of Holies. These were just priests. Okay, well, David, this is before the temple was built. David was attacking a city. And the people he was attacking jeered at him, and they said, "You're never going to attack us. Our blind and our lame can repel you. We're not a bit worried about you." Well, David attacked the city. He conquered the city. He took the city, and he jeered back at them about their blind and their lame. Okay, and so David said, "From now on, no blind man and no lame man will enter my palace." Okay, David promptly ignored his own edict when he brought Jonathan's son, who was lame, into his house and took care of him for the rest of his life because he was Jonathan's son, which, by the way, he lived to regret that, David did. But the point is that Solomon then came along and took that idea of his father David, that the blind and the lame were not allowed in the palace, and he combined that with the idea that the blind and the lame priests were not allowed in the temple, and he made a sweeping edict saying blind and lame are not allowed in this new temple that I just built. Okay? So when Jesus comes and heals the blind and the lame, he's healing them right at the temple. So they come to the temple. Jesus is at the temple. They have been walled off from the temple for all this time. Jesus heals them. They're no longer walled off. This is why the Pharisees are so upset with Jesus healing at the temple, because they have built this fence. Do you remember the fences? So God's law says, do this, don't do that. The Pharisees came along and built fences around the law by saying, well, yes, God says to fast on this one day, so I'm going to fast for 3 days just to make sure. God says not to do this one thing, but I'm going to not even get close to doing it. So these fences started to be built up. So God said, blind and lame priests are not allowed to do this, but this fence is built. Now, no blind and lame, because we don't want to take a chance on offending God in this particular area. So that's what the fences are. So Jesus, when he's healing the blind and the lame, he comes right up against this fence at the temple. Instead of tearing the fence down, he heals the people that the fence is blocking out. Okay? So do you see this is more than just Jesus displaying his power? Do you see what he's doing here? He's giving signs. He's saying, this is the sign of God's mercy and grace is now extended to all people. There's that fence is not going to keep you out anymore. So the sign of this comes from Ezekiel. 34:16 is the verse that I picked, but the whole chapter of Ezekiel and much of the book of Ezekiel sounds just like this. God says, I myself will seek what was lost and bring back what was driven away. So these people have been driven away from the temple. I will bind up the broken. I will strengthen what was sick. That's the healing that he's doing. But I will destroy the fat and the strong. Those are the people who are pushing the weak ones away. And he gives an example of, he gives a metaphor of a ram and a sheep. The ram is butting the sheep and trying to keep, the fat sheep are keeping the lean sheep away from the food. So this is the sign that Jesus is doing, right? We've already talked about that. This is still review. He gave us the sign of the Sabbath. He healed on the Sabbath. The Pharisees and the Sadducees would say, how can he do this? He can't be from God if he's doing this. But look, God is blessing him and he can do it. So God must be behind him. They were confused about the sign of the Sabbath. But that sign is that, yes, Jesus can do things on the Sabbath because he is the God that is allowed to work on the Sabbath. We got the sign of Moses, the feeding of the 5,000, the sign of the manna, the prophet who was promised to Moses, who has not shown up yet in Israel, the one that the people are expecting. He would be a prophet like Moses. He knew God face to face. That's what they were looking for in this prophet, and they recognized this in the feeding of the 5,000, the sign, not just the power. Walking on water, We saw the echoes of the Red Sea miracle in Jesus walking on water. Not just power, not just a miracle, not just a magic trick, but a sign to the people, this is the one who was promised. So we're going to go now to the very first sign. Like I said, I'm doing this backwards, right? We're going to go to the very first sign. This is in John 2. This is the wedding at Cana. At the end of that story, we heard Dennis read, this was the first sign that Jesus did. He did this to manifest his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Okay? Not just power. There had to be something behind what Jesus did to be important enough for them to believe in him. So we're going to take a look at that. First, I will give you some information about Israelite weddings in this time period. They're a little different than the weddings that we do today, right? So we have expectations. When we get an invitation to a wedding, we expect it to go a certain way. We go to usually a church. We see the ceremony. After the ceremony, we go to a church basement or to a different place, and we're given food. Sometimes there's dancing, depending on what you're... If you're not Baptist, you know, you might have some dancing at your wedding, but... And it goes on for, maybe 2 hours, depending on if you're just eating snacks or if you're eating a dinner. If it goes on much more than like 3 hours, we start going, I gotta get home, I gotta plow my driveway, I gotta shovel my snow, whatever, right? Okay, so you want to take like part of a day and then you want to be done with it. Okay, not the same in Jewish weddings. My daughter married into an Armenian family. And we were woefully ignorant about Armenian wedding customs. And her husband's family kept asking us, how much money do you need? And we were like, we're the bride's parents. Don't we pay for the wedding? And they're like, no, tell us, what, can't we buy anything? Can't we pay for something? Can't we help you? Can't we organize something? And we're like, you know, they were in California. The wedding was up here. And we're like, no, we've got this under control, right? Okay. So in the Armenian custom, the groom's family pays for the wedding, everything from the bridal dress to just everything, like the groom's mother takes the bride shopping and buys her her dress. It's very much different. Well, so we went to my son-in-law's brother's wedding, and he was marrying an Armenian girl, and so it was an Armenian wedding. It started at 8 o'clock in the morning, where she got her wedding dress on, and people started to come by to visit. They had a wedding breakfast. They did all sorts of stuff in the morning. Then they had this ceremony. And then they did other stuff. And then they started in on the meal. And then they had a late night snack. And then they had dancing. And the uncles were over in the corner drinking vodka. And it was an Armenian wedding. And it ended about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I did not stay that long because I was the grandchild babysitter. But that's what time everybody got home was about too. So even in our culture, we have different wedding ideas. In the Jewish culture, the weddings would last for days. So when the story starts out, it says Jesus, on the third day, Jesus went to a wedding. So the question is, on the third day of what? It's not super important, but it's very possible that Jesus was traveling to Cana and arrived at the wedding on the third day of the wedding. It could be the third day of the week, because often weddings would start on the third day of the week, because the fourth day of the week is the day that a wedding was supposed to be consummated. So the wedding would start, the ceremony would happen, people would start feasting. After a while, the bride and the groom would disappear, and people still feasted, and they went on and they feasted, and then the next day the bride and the groom came back, and the feast went on until the wine ran out. When the wine ran out, that was the end of the feast. Okay, so this is the wedding expectation in Jesus' time. Men and women celebrate in separate houses. So they're not together. The men are all over, and that's the important one. They're all over in one part celebrating, because essentially, for the men, it's a business deal. The women are all over in a different house celebrating as well. Different kinds of celebration. The guests were expected to bring gifts. Okay, so we have that in our culture, but their gifts were different. They were expected to bring either food or drink or money. If they brought food or drink, it was sucked in to the wedding feast and then dispersed as the wedding feast. If they brought money, a certain amount of the money was deducted for that guest's wedding feast expenses, and then the rest would go to the couple for them setting up their houses, their housing. So a little bit different in the gift area, but here's the thing. In a community like this, when you gave somebody a gift, they incurred an obligation to re-gift you. So the next time something came up, if your own child was getting married, you were expected to give the same or greater to this particular family. And people did keep accounts. And in a small community that had been established for a very long time, the accounts were kept for a very long time. And this was actually enforceable at law. You could take someone to court if you didn't get back what you expected to get back. I don't know how often this happened. But it is encoded in the law from that era. Okay, now if you had a visiting rabbi come to your wedding, the couple who was getting married was considered extra blessed. So this is an extra blessing for a visiting rabbi to be at this wedding. The visiting rabbi is not expected to bring a gift. He's expected to be poor. And he was not allowed to supply a gift from the community funds of his band, of his traveling band. So the rabbi himself could not supply the feast. But according to law, the rabbi's father was responsible for providing food or wine for the feast. Okay? Does that seem like it might be important to you? Keep a hold of that idea, right? Okay, so here's Jesus, a visiting rabbi, at a wedding. He has not yet presented the gift from his father. The people are at Cana. We know that because we read the passage. This wedding is happening at Cana. Cana is a town in Galilee, and the area where they think Cana was is an area where priests had settled. So Jewish priests from Jerusalem had moved to that area. They had settled in that area. The idea was that they were trying to bring a more perfect following of the Jewish law to the people in Galilee who were known to be, they didn't think it was quite so important up there in Galilee. And so these priests had settled up there, and their idea was, let's show these people that it really is important to keep these laws that were really fences. So it's very possible that this wedding is happening within a priestly family. The reason we can say that is because we see that there's 6 stone jars there. And these stone jars are very important jars. Because there's 6 of them is why we think that it's a priestly family. So the stone jars were used for the water that was used for the purification rites. And in Jerusalem, if you wanted to do the purification rites, they had what's called mikvahs. And you would go immerse yourself in this mikvah. And when you came out, you were pure. Doesn't matter how dirty the water was, it was a purification rite. But they didn't have those up in Galilee. But 6 stone jars would hold about the same amount of water that the mikvah would hold. So this would be the priest's attempt to duplicate the idea of the purification with the mikvah. And so this is what they would do. This is how they would purify themselves. It was very important. One of the axioms of the whole purification ritual is that if unclean touches clean, clean becomes unclean. The kingdom of heaven, when clean touches unclean, unclean becomes clean. So there's a difference there. I hope I said that right. Okay, this is how they would purify themselves. This is like a second best purification because they're using water that is drawn from a well, and the best purification is spring water. Okay, but this water was drawn from a well. They had this cup, like a dipper, and there was 2 handles that came out of the dipper. And the unclean hand would touch a handle. That handle is now unclean. They would dip the water and pour it over the other hand. This hand is now clean. This hand takes the handle, the other handle of the dipper, doesn't contaminate it because this hand is clean. Okay, this hand is unclean. Dip the dipper back in and pour it over this hand. Now both hands are clean. Okay? So this was important to do, and to a priestly family it was important to do a lot because they did not just want to be clean. They wanted to be seen to be clean. So they would wait until there's a gathering of people, and then they would cleanse themselves. They would purify themselves. So this is what those stone jars are being used for at this time. This indicates that this particular family was very concerned with the purity laws. So once again, probably a priestly family, probably a wealthy family. Okay, so the story itself. We have often looked at this story and read it as an allegory. And some of you know how I am not real fond of the idea of allegory, partly because the Jews simply did not use allegory for teaching in this time period. This didn't come till much later. But we read into it an allegorical interpretation. So we say, okay, the wine, the water in the jars is an allegory of the Jewish purity laws. Jesus changes the water to wine. The wine is a symbol of his blood and how the blood, the wine of the gospel is replacing the water of the Jewish ritual system. Would the disciples have understood that when they were looking at this story? They would not. Wine was not a symbol to them of blood, but wine was a symbol to them of celebration. So, some of the other allegories that we get from this are there's six pots. Right? That's the number of the days of the week. It's also the number of man. And so the allegory is that man is striving through all the 6 days of the week for his own salvation. But on the seventh day, the blood of Christ comes. Anyway, I can go on and on with the allegories. The thing about allegories is you don't know what they mean unless somebody tells you what they mean. Right? So allegories are no good for teaching purposes unless you already know the key to figure them out. So this is not an allegory. We should not be reading this story as an allegory. So Jesus and his disciples are at a wedding and the wine runs out. And we are not told why the wine runs out. Is it the third day of the wedding? Is it the third day of the week and the wedding has just started? It just does not tell us. It's unusual for the wine to run out. Doesn't tell us why it happened. Jesus' mother comes to him. That means that she has to leave the house where the women are celebrating. She has to enter the house where the men are celebrating, thereby possibly contaminating the house, and they're going to have to all go through the purity ritual again. But very odd thing for her to do, to go into that house where Jesus was as the visiting rabbi. He's like a special guest, so it's not like he's just mingling with the crowd. So she says to him, she doesn't ask, she doesn't tell him to do something, she just gives him information. The wine is all gone. They've run out of wine. Okay? What follows from that is probably the most enigmatic statement that Jesus has made. He says, literally, what to you and to me? That's it, right? What in the world does that mean? Okay, we do have some clues. This is used several places in the Old Testament and the New Testament as well. And as always, we take that to mean it's not our problem, right? What is that? What's the problem to you and to me? This is not our problem. We don't have to worry about it. But what to you and to me is an idiom that encompasses a relationship. So this is something between you and me. What is this between you and me? But because it's an idiom, it even goes beyond just the words that we're looking at, and it's talking about why is this part of our relationship? So the idiom here is, in the way Jesus is using it, is going to be This is not your responsibility, he's saying to his mother. Okay, this is not something that you have to do because of me, because I'm the visiting rabbi and you're the mother, and apparently Joseph is not in the picture anymore. You don't have to worry about it. He's saying to her, don't worry about it. This is not your responsibility. My father will take care of this responsibility. Okay, once before we've heard Jesus talk about his father and the importance of his father. So instead of looking at that statement where Jesus says, woman, this is not our problem, we should be looking at that. First of all, woman is not a derogatory term. It's not a filial term, but it simply means something like madam. He would be saying, madam, this is not your problem. That's what he's saying to his mother. So he's stepping away from her a little bit by not saying mom, because if he said mom, it would be her problem. So this is madam, not your problem. This is my father's problem. My father and I will fix this. Sorry. And then when he says, my hour is not yet come. We see this in John a lot. Jesus is talking about his hour is coming. That hour is the hour of the cross. So what he's doing when he's saying that is reassuring his mother that nothing bad is going to happen. So rather than looking at this, like we have said, okay, so it looks like Jesus is being rude to his mother and he's not going to do it, but then he goes and does it. And did she need to push him to get him started and to remind him that he was the Messiah and was supposed to be saving the world? And what's her role in this? But that's not what this phrase would mean to the people who are hearing it. So once again, the phrase means, it's not your problem. I know it seems like it should be because these are the rules and the laws that we have to keep, but it's not your problem. My father will take care of it. And don't worry, nothing bad is going to happen to me today. Okay? So, when you're reading that now, I want you to think about that instead of trying to figure out why Jesus is being so rude to his mother. So, Jesus is not confused. He knows what he's going to do. He knows what's going to happen. Okay, so we have the pots. We're back to those pots again. Jesus could have taken some old wineskins and put some aged wine in the wineskins, or put the water and changed that with the water into wine in the wineskins. That would have been the easiest way to do this. But instead, he takes these jars, stone jars, holding 20 or 30 gallons. Now, how many of you want to pick up an empty stone jar and carry it to the well, fill it with 20 or 30 gallons of water, and then carry it back, right? So this is not how they did it. The servants would have gone to the well with buckets, drawn the water, and brought it back to the stone jars and poured it into the jars. Okay, remember when I said that water that was drawn from a well was not good, not the best for the purity rituals? If you draw water from a well and then top off drawn water, that makes it practically worthless for purity rituals. So just the action of them drawing the water and topping off water in the jar destroyed the water for the intended use. Okay, now, Jesus changes that water into wine. I'm sorry. You should have brought a glass of water up here with me. When Jesus changes that water into wine, there's no more ability for the people to go through the purification ritual because they can't do it from those jars anymore because the jars are filled with wine. By the way, 6 jars, 30 gallons, that's 180 gallons of wine. The party's going to go on for a while, right? Okay, and once again, what Jesus is doing here is he's breaking down one of those fences. So the law from Moses talks about purity and it talks about cleaning your hands. But the idea that you have to do it a certain way and that you have to do it a certain number of times and that certain things will make a pure or a clean thing unclean, those are all fences that the Sadducees and the Pharisees have put up over the years. Jesus is once again breaking through these fences. So the fences come down so that the people can see the beauty of God's law. This is a private miracle. Jesus' mother knew, Jesus' disciples knew, the servants knew, but none of the guests at the wedding knew what Jesus had done. Okay, so from the perspective of the guests at the wedding, Jesus' father or family has now supplied the expected wedding gift. That's what they're seeing. Okay, Jesus' disciples, Jesus' mom, those servants, they have seen something different. So they've seen the sign, and this is the time to get out your notes. We're going to talk about what the sign points to. So Isaiah 24 and 25. Isaiah 24 through 27 is considered to be a prophecy of the messianic times. We're not going to read the whole thing. We're not even going to read the whole paper that I passed out to you. It's just I did so much work on parsing out the prophecy into the poetic form that I'm like, you guys, you're going to get these papers anyway, right? But don't worry, we won't read the whole thing. But it is interesting. If you're a poetry nerd, read through it and you'll be able to see like the form of the poetry and that kind of stuff. And it was also very complicated, and I'm not claiming that I'm even right on the way I parsed it out, because it was just really complicated. And if you don't know Hebrew, like if you don't speak Hebrew, it's hard sometimes to see parallels. So let's go there. So prophecies are considered to have cycles of three. And if you go through the prophecies in the Old Testament, sometimes you can see the three cycles, like there'll be this prophecy, and the first cycle that they think is part of the prophecy will happen, but it'll end here. And then maybe 600 years later, the prophecy seems like it's coming true again, but this time it ends over here. And a lot of times those prophecies are not fully complete, and we're waiting for the entire prophecy to be completed. And this is one of those prophecies. When you read through it, at first glance, it looks like it's a prophecy of the Babylonian captivity that would be coming when Isaiah was writing the prophecy. So he talks about the destruction of the land and the sadness of the people and a remnant being left behind, that sort of stuff, okay? But it doesn't fully complete. And then at second glance, it looks like it might be a prophecy of what's going to happen in just a couple years when the Romans come in and destroy the temple and destroy Jerusalem, because you see the city falling and the people being sad and da-da-da, right? Okay, but there's part of that prophecy that hasn't come true yet, and we're going to take a look at that, all right? So that's the cycles that we see of the prophecy. Okay, so Isaiah 24 and Isaiah 25, in general, their form comes out to be this inverted parallelism, or as Kenneth Bailey calls it, the prophetic rhetorical template, right? When I actually tried to lay it out, the poetry itself did not fit into this template, but the ideas do. So let's take a quick look at the ideas. So Isaiah 24 starts out with the Lord judging the inhabitants of the earth. And the reason is because these inhabitants have defiled the earth. Because of that, there is no joy in the city, which is symbolized by there's no wine. The city is desolate. But there's a remnant who will continue to glorify God. But there's no escape. The earth is going to fall, and the Lord is going to punish the rulers of the earth. Just see those parallels there, right? Okay, Isaiah 25, there's praise because the Lord has destroyed the city. They're looking to God for salvation. And the symbol of the salvation is abundant wine. The Lord is going to bring ultimate salvation. And we, his people, are waiting for his salvation. And the Lord is going to destroy the enemies. So you see again those parallels, right? Okay, let's take a look now at the actual text. I'm one of those tree huggers that likes to save trees by printing on the backs and fronts of paper, you know? And so I thought I was doing that. And I went back to the printer from my office and discovered that I wasn't doing that at all. So I destroyed a couple of trees that didn't need to be destroyed by not printing fronts and backs. Okay, I want to take a look at the blues, because the blues are the heart of the prophecy as far as the Jews are concerned. Okay, I'll go ahead and read through that, clear through to the end of Isaiah 25. In the city, desolation is left. With a great tumult, the gate is battered down. Its transgression shall be heavy upon it. It will fall and not rise again. At that time, the moon will be disgraced and the sun ashamed. Because of this destruction of the city, the mighty people will honor you. The cities of the ruthless nations will fear you. The shame of his people he will take away from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken. So do you see how you don't even hardly need the details? You just get kind of a general overall view of what this prophecy is about and what's going to happen. And as I said, this goes clear through till Isaiah 27, but I didn't go that far. Okay, now I want to take a look at the ones that I have highlighted in red here. So I'm going to read those to you as well. And as I'm reading those to you, I want you to look at what Jesus has done at this wedding through the eyes of the disciples who know this prophecy. The new wine fails, the vine languishes, all the merry-hearted sigh, the party is over. The mirth of the tambourine ceases, the noise of jubilation ends, the joy of the harp ceases. There is a cry for wine in the streets, all joy is darkened, the mirth of the land is gone. When this happens in the midst of the land, among the people shall be a remnant, like the shaking of an olive tree, like the gleaning of grapes when the harvest is done. They shall lift up their voice. They shall sing of the majesty of the Lord. They shall cry aloud from the west. I'll skip two pages. On this mountain, the Lord Almighty will prepare for all people a feast of choice foods, a feast of aged wines, of the best of rich foods, of the finest of aged wines. On this mountain, he will destroy the shroud that covers the face of all peoples, the veil that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death in victory. And the Lord God will wipe away tears from all faces. And it will be said in that day, behold, this is our God. We have waited for him and he will save us. This is the Lord. We have waited for him. We will be glad and rejoice in his salvation. All right. Does that sound like something the disciples might have thought about when the cry for wine rose at the wedding feast? And when the best of the finest and aged wine was supplied by Jesus at the wedding feast. So this is the sign, not the power, that Jesus can take H2O and turn it into whatever the chemical constitution of wine is. Okay, Jesus can do that. Yes, he's got the power to do this. But the point is the sign, what's behind the power. So the surface miracle, he broke the fences around the purity laws. He gave a gift from his father, claiming God as his father. He helped out a family in a moment of crisis, in just one little small moment. But the why, the sign points to the why Jesus came. Okay, this is the inauguration of the kingdom of heaven. This is the beginning of the end times. Death is going to be swallowed up in victory. We haven't seen that part of the prophecy come true yet. Okay, there's going to be rejoicing in his salvation. So Jesus did this, the text tells us, to manifest his glory. Now, what in the world does that mean? Okay, so manifest, that means to show, to spread around, to display his glory. But if I were to ask you, what does the word glory mean? What would you say? How would you describe the word glory? It's a very abstract word, but as I've said before, Hebrew is based on concrete images. And the image, or the word, the root word that we get the word glory from means heavy or weighty. And it's used to show importance. So the heavier something is, the more important it is. And that's the word that we get glory from. So Jesus is manifesting his importance, his overarching importance in the inauguration of the kingdom of heaven. That's what glory should mean in this particular case. The disciples saw it, and did they understand the sign? Well, it says the disciples believed. And this belief is not just, okay, one time I believe thing, but it's a a continual growing belief. We can say the disciples began to believe. This is when they began to say, oh, there's something different about this guy. He's not just really smart. He's not just really nice. He's not just really powerful. But there's something different. They began to believe that he was involved in the kingdom of heaven. So Jesus is going to bring the expectation of the messianic age to its intended climax. That's what they're looking at, and that's what they're going to accept. Okay, so they didn't know what that was going to look like. They were just hanging on for dear life. They were just along for the ride. Okay, so all those other stories that we already talked about in John, that's them hanging on for dear life. At the end, Jesus brings this all the way, at the end of the story, the whole story that John gives us at the end of Jesus' life, he brings us all the way back around to this same prophecy, this Isaiah 25 prophecy. When he raises Lazarus from the dead, death will be swallowed up in victory. So he starts out the first sign. He starts out by providing abundant wine when there is no wine. His last sign, death is swallowed up in victory, just like it said in Isaiah 25. The idea is not just look how powerful Jesus is, but the idea is look at what this means. This means that God is with us and that his kingdom is coming on earth today. So let's pray. Dear Father, please give us eyes to see the importance of the things that you do and the importance of the things that you say and how they point to facts that could deepen our belief if we could understand them and give us just a solid bedrock to stand on. Thank you for giving us all these words, and let us take them to heart. In your name, amen.